D-Mace, Vingan, and Donna coming your way here on a Thursday afternoon in October. Yes, it's October, my favorite sports month. Willie Donick, Derek Mason here with you. Adam Vingan is off today. He'll be back with us tomorrow. We'll be back at full strength. We've got a lot to get into today. We are going to take it to another level with the big weekend coming up in college football. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's really no non-big weekends, especially in the SEC, where it is a really intriguing race with a lot of teams that are going to have a shot at the playoffs. And, of course, here locally, Vanderbilt against Alabama, maybe the biggest spotlight, the biggest glare for a single game that Vanderbilt football has ever earned, with game day and the 2:30 afternoon kickoff on national TV on ABC, on free TV.
Oh, yeah.
Free TV, the game of the week, the featured game. This is going to be big. Mitch Light is going to join us at 3:40. We'll get his perspective on it. We'll talk about something that Joe Dubin discovered and passed along on the show, and we said, hey, wow, that was good stuff, about the roster construction of some of the teams in the SEC in this day and age of staying in college football longer, NIL, hanging around, not just jumping to the draft, and maybe earn a little cash while you do it. But what does that do to the competitive balance of the league? We're going to talk about that a little bit later. We'll talk a lot of Titans here in a moment. Quick update, D-Mace. You know I love updates. D-Mace and the Tigers trying to eliminate Cleveland.
We need to.
There are three rubber matches today, three deciding game threes. Mm-hmm. Congratulations to Mookie Betts and the Dodgers, who eliminated the Reds last night.
Yes.
Mookie Betts had a big game, had three doubles last night. And the Dodgers have advanced. But you've got Tigers-Guardians going on right now. Tigers leading 1-0 in the top of the fourth in Cleveland and trying to add to it right now. They've got a leadoff man on in the fourth. Runs have been very hard to score. Very good pitching on both of these teams. Later today, it will be at Wrigley Field, Padres-Cubs. Winner advances. And then, of course, Yankees-Red Sox tonight.
How about that game last night?
Great game. Some great games
going on.
In these very tight games, great playoff feel, great atmospheres at all the parks. So we'll just keep you up to date on those throughout the afternoon. And Joe Rexroad is going to join us today at 5:20. Mm-hmm. He is a noted Tigers fan, mm-hmm. So we'll see what kind of mood he's in at 5:20. He should know the verdict of the Tigers by 5:20.
Hopefully, a good move. Like let's hope.
I think
for a good
we
move.
All will be in a good mood. But they got rocked the other day. Whew, it wasn't good. I'm starting to hate the Yankees.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'm starting to hate the Yankees.
Well, you're not alone.
Yeah.
Welcome to the club.
There you go. I was just where'd
you get that?
I don't know. It just came upon me, you know?
It's just a natural feeling, isn't it?
Because you're Red Sox. You're by proxy, you're a Red Sox fan. Obviously, Aaron was a big Red Sox fan.
I married into a massive
Red
Sox
nation.
Yeah,
so that's why
nation.
I hate the Yankees now. So there you go. I hate the Yankees. I'm hoping for a Red Sox World Series.
Well, we'll find out tonight. They've got to win tonight. Two very tight games. Red Sox won game one. Yankees came back and pulled it out last night. A game that was tight all the way, and the Yankees got the big hit, held on. So we'll keep an eye on the games, but we're going to talk a lot about the Titans, et cetera. A lot of college football today. We'll mix in some Preds as well, because for the Predators, they are now 1 week away from the start of the regular season, and they have made another roster move today to whittle the roster down to 27 players. Defenseman Andreas Englund, who is basically the seventh or eighth defenseman, maybe ninth, depending on who you count, if you count injured players, he passed through waivers, so they have sent him to Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. So they're down to 27 players. You have to get to a maximum of 23, D-Mace, but two players we know are going to start the year on the injured list in Nick Hague, a defenseman, and Matthew Wood. So it's really at 25. There are two more moves that they have to make. I'm guessing they're going to take, I don't know this, but they could take a look at Tanner Molendijk for another few days of practice, maybe even put him in the game on Saturday, the last preseason tune-up. They really like him, a young up-and-coming defenseman. And then they've got to decide what to do with Brady Martin, their first pick. He's only 18. Joakim Kemmel's in there. And then, of course, the elephant in the room that continues to be Luke Evangelista, still not signed. No word on that. And so at 4:45, we're going to talk about that a little bit more. I want to get D. Mace's player perspective, player agent perspective, because regardless of sport, negotiations, it's the business part of it, is important. And you've got to make tough decisions. Yeah. And I'm sure Luke Evangelista is anxious and raring to go. He's got a week. How long do you wait before you just take the best offer? We'll try to give you as best we can. If you missed Predators Insiders last night, Adam and I really got down deep into what are the comparables, what are they asking for, what are we hearing the Predators are at, and then what do we think is the real value of Luke Evangelista, given that he's coming off a down year. He took a step backwards last year after a really nice year the year before. We'll get into that at 4:45. But let's start with this, D-Mace. And David, if you can, let's get the Denard Wilson clip going. One thing that we talked about that we hadn't had a chance to really delve into this week yet with all of the other stuff going on with Cam Ward. And by the way, Cam Ward is going to be a big part of our topic in the 5 o'clock hour. We've got some numbers we're going to throw at you in just how tough the environment is around him and what can they do as best they can with the limited personnel they have to create the best environment possible. But in the meantime, there was a play that I think deserves a little bit more discussion. The game on Sunday, the Titans are trailing 6-0. It's not a blowout. We sit here on Monday, and the final score is 26-0. Everybody's like, oh, what an embarrassment. 26-0. They got killed. Mm-hmm. But if you watch the game, they missed two field goals in the first half. Mm-hmm. Game should have been closer. And they're still only down 6-0 in the second half, a few minutes into the third quarter, third possession for the. And it is 2nd and 33. Mm-hmm. You should get the ball back with a chance to make one big play. And, hey, you could pull a little nervous Nelly into their crowd. They're 0-3. Mm-hmm. So they have been in some of these games, but this is an example of what has happened to them. They get the bomb, and you and I were both curious about what happened on the 2nd and 33. Everybody remembers it because the theme is, oh, L'Jarius Sneed got burned. Mm-hmm. He did all the talking. He acted like he didn't know who the receiver was, Nico Collins. And sure enough, Nico Collins gets a gain of 38 on a 2nd and 33. Mm-mm-mm. Par for the course on how the key plays have gone for the Titans. So I asked Teron, what happened on that play? Teron was like, let me ask the defensive coordinator. So you know what Teron did? He asked the defensive coordinator. So I want to play this for everybody. And then D-Mace, I want to get your take because I think you spelled it out Monday pretty well with your speculation. But here's Denard Wilson on that pivotal play in the game.
It's like this. It's for all the players. We got to understand the situation of football, right? We got them backed up. It's 2nd and 33. I made a call. It was a call to keep a roof on top of the defense. And he went and pressed. And then, you know, even from pressing, he should have been outside leverage regardless, whether he was off or on. But he just has to have better awareness of the situation. And if I have to put a call to make them get off, I have to do that. Also, with what you don't notice, the safety also left from the hash. We supposed to have been zoning a quarter playing cover four. And once the safety pushed to the hash, the quarterback, I mean, it was one step and the ball was up. So it's not just LJ. He has to understand the situation, but we have to execute the details of the defense and the coverage to take the quarterback off of the X.
Okay, so let's do a little bit of interpretation here, D-Mace. Outside leverage, what does that mean? And so when you translate what happened there, because he gave a lot of details there. Like some coordinators might shut that down, but he opened it up because these are two veteran players. Mm-hmm. We're talking about L'Jarius Sneed and Quandre Diggs. They've been around the block way too much for that to happen. So explain what happened based on what you heard.
Well, when I first saw it, I knew instantly that, because I think I even text you guys, like, that was a busted coverage. Like, somebody did something wrong because the way L'Jarius Sneed opened up, he thought it was man coverage. He thought he was playing some type of man, whether it was straight up man-to-man or man-under, which is cover two man, or shell over the top, man underneath. That's the way he opened up. And then thought about it a little bit more. Well, It was either him blowing the coverage or the safety not getting over the top. One or both were at fault in this. Come to find out, it was both. But L'Jarius Sneed compounded the problem because Denard Wilson, when he first explained it, he said if he opens up with leverage on the outside, he can see. Basically, if he opens up and give him the inside track, he can see the football. Back up a little bit, open up so you can see the football, so you stay on top of your receiver. He didn't do that. He opened up as if it was man coverage. And he got beat. He just let the, he didn't put his hands on him. He just let the guy run outside. He gave no outside leverage. You gave this man a free release. And the safety isn't playing the right coverage. So even if the safety blows it and he runs to the middle of the field or he comes down and try to take a part of the zone and maybe the safety thought it was cover three, so he was rolling down to that zone. Even if L'Jarius Sneed opens up to the outside, he still can see the football. And he can notice, I don't have a safety in the middle. I don't have a safety to my side. But he didn't. But because he opened up and gave me outside track, he couldn't see anything. It's man to man to him. Or he thought he was going to have help over the top. Those are the little things that dooms a bad team. When you're not communicating or not playing the right technique in a said defense or the offense, this is what gets you beat. You're not good enough, and you haven't played good enough, meaning L'Jarius Sneed, to do your own thing. That's basically, and Denard said, if I got to make a call to tell you to stay on here, then that's what I got to do. What he's saying is that if I got to get elementary on you, then that's what I need to do.
That's what jumped out at me is these are veteran players, especially Sneed. Wouldn't you just sense on 2nd and 33 that, you know, if you're not sure or something, like you've got to give some cushion there. Like, it's impossible how easy that was to that player in that situation.
It was a blown coverage and a blown technique.
So are you okay saying that that's on the players not getting the call, not understanding? What I'm getting at is my theory of the coaches are getting blasted every week, right? Especially the head coach. But can you put that on the defensive coordinator? Should they have just called just more elementary stuff, as you said, and said, "Look, he talked about a roof," and all you can think about when somebody says roof is Michael Jordan. The ceiling is the roof. But on 2nd and 33. NFL, you cannot give up a play that easy to their best player on a three-step drop.
And that's what I'm saying, Willie.
If they complete a miraculous play down the field, I could see it, but that was easy.
And that's what I mean by knowing, like really being dialed in. This is what coaches talk about, being dialed in. Some guys take it and say, I'm dialed in. And then they end up, busting several plays. No, you're not dialed in. Dialed in means, from a technique standpoint, you are locked in. You're locked into what you're doing from a technique standpoint. From a play standpoint, you know exactly what you're doing against any coverage. Or if you're a defensive back, you know exactly what call is made and what your responsibilities are. He wasn't locked in. There was a miscommunication. And what are some of the things that have ailed this franchise? Communication, the lack of, or the not sharing fully what's going on. So not only do you have a miscommunication, and maybe I'm thinking about this a little bit too big. Maybe I'm dissecting this a little bit too much, and I get it. But when you're not a winning organization, you're trying to find any and everything, trying to find what is truly causing this. Like, all the little – that's why coaches talk about make sure you do the little things as the season gets going, as the season, gets in that sort of haze of it's just game after game after game and everybody's tired. Make sure you pay attention to the little things. Keep doing it. So much so, keep coming in at what time you come in at the beginning of the season. Just keep coming in. Keep eating the same thing. Make sure y'all pick up in the locker room. These are things that as the season goes, people tend to say, oh, I'll do that later. Or I'll do this later. That's why coaches tell you, like, this is a long season, lock in. And this team, for whatever reason, there's this lack of communication going all around from the top to the players. Little things like them not communicating what the defense was. Him deciding that he wanted to play his own coverage instead of the coverage that was called. Little things like that ultimately doom bad teams.
But even if, okay, so this is what shocks me about it. If there were two rookies, that would be one thing. But even so, on second and 33, come on, this is elementary football. You cannot get beat on a play like that on second and 33. But that aside, we're talking about two veterans. Like, Quandre Diggs, where was he? Like, he slipped it in there at the end. The safety
came down.
Shouldn't have come down. So, two veterans do that? That doesn't help filter down when you're trying to find anybody, you know, to build around.
It's
so disappointing. I couldn't believe that play. I'm still astonished that happened.
There are like 10 guys on this team, and we talked about this weeks ago, that you knew coming into the season, the only way this team had a chance at having some resemblance of a good season is if those players all play well and they stay healthy. Those key players. What has happened at the beginning of the season to those key players? None of them, other than Jeffrey Simmons, Xavier Woods is playing well, Peter Skoronski, and let's throw McQuarrie in there. The rest of them aren't holding, either they're not on the field, J.C. Latham and Tajay Spears, or they're not truly holding up their end of the bargain. Throw Pollard in there too, because he is. But when your marquee players don't hold up their end of the bargain, how do you expect to win? And Snead isn't holding up any of his bargain. So how do you fans expect to win? The coaches, they coach and try to put the players in the best position they can. And I'm not saying that Brian Callahan is doing an excellent job at that. But when your players, your marquee players, don't show up to play every game, every play, how do you expect to win?
615-737-1025. We're just getting started here on DVD, which is presented by Bax Homeworks. Bax Homeworks transforms kitchens, bathrooms, and living spaces into places you can't wait to come home to. So, financing options are available to make your remodel easier than you think with Bax Homeworks. When we come back, we'll get some reaction to this. 615-737-1025. Call or text anytime. And we'll continue to talk some Titans in the next segment. Can this team win a game anytime soon? They still have some major injury issues. But what do you think of the theme that I'm throwing out? They are losing way more because of the roster than they are the coaching. I know the coaches are taking way high of a percentage of the heat. They deserve some. I think it's disproportionate. We'll stay with that theme when we come back here on DVD. DVD continues, broadcasting to the Busy Bee Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning Game Nashville Studios, home of the $99 yearly Beehive membership, where the buzz is always about great service. 615-737-1025. That is our game text and calling hotline. Willie Donk, Derek Mason here with you. The Guardians have tied the game against the Tigers, the all-decisive Game 3 in the wild card round, 1-1 in the top of the fifth with the Tigers at bat. So, D-Mace, we got a couple of texts on our text line, which is driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com. Here is one that is from Gino that I think is interesting, because we're getting this theme some. Because my theme is, I want to find out if we're dividing up the pie of why they are where they are, which is towards the bottom. What percentage is fair to put on the coaches? What percentage is fair to put on the roster? Mm-hmm. We both know that they don't look like a well-coached team, but also the roster is lacking. I think it's way higher percentage on the roster. But here is Gino's take. The Titans have gotten rid of most of the players/leaders that knew how to win. Team is full of people that don't know how to close out a game. Tough spot right now. So I'm curious, when he texts that, what players he's talking about, because we can go into the past of the last really good Titans team and talk about Kevin Byard and players like him that have aged out, right? What has gone wrong is they have not replenished, because Kevin Byard is not helping a team right now, if that's the type of player you're talking about, or Danico Autry, or other pieces that were part of the teams that won a lot of games in 2019, 2020, 2021.
This is the, I think, because I'm looking up, is Kevin Byard on a team right now?
I don't think so.
I'm not
sure. I could be wrong.
Or he could be with the Bears. Is he still with the Bears? I know he was with them last season. I'm not sure he's with them.
It looks like he's still with the Bears.
He's still with the Bears.
From what it says, but I can double check again. So
yeah, he's still with the Bears. He has
played the four games with the Bears.
Yeah, he's playing well right now.
Three interceptions.
18 solos, three interceptions, three pass defenses.
He is 32.
32 years old. I think what happens, and, you know, I think a lot of fans, when their team get in a rut, and when I mean a rut, I mean a long one, not just a season, maybe two. I'm talking consistency of bad football. Is that they romanticize about the past team or the past leaders that can still have some connection or maybe still in the NFL. So they're looking at guys like Derrick Henry, Kevin Byard, guys that are still playing. And there may be a few other guys that are still out there that are still playing that was once Tennessee Titans, that were a part of, you know, this team winning football games, at least that last year. And when you lose a Byard and you lose a Derrick Henry, and then you see one of the two, and now it seems like, you know, Kevin Byard he started off on a good note with this season. So you see both of these guys having some success at their other teams. And you think, well, if we would have kept those guys, you know, we'd be winning. You had those guys and you wasn't winning. That's why they said, hey, listen, we still understand that you guys may have something still left in the tank, but we are in a position right now where holding on to you isn't beneficial to anybody.
We know people are listening because they have flooded our text line with, hey, he just had two interceptions in the last game.
Exactly.
Sorry about that. My bad. Just seeing if you're paying attention. Thanks for texting.
Pay attention to
everyone. Literally, y'all were still there. That's all.
Eight texts in like three seconds. But I think it's a great question, because if they still had – we've had this discussion about what would Derrick Henry have looked like if he had stayed in a Titans uniform. Would they have been winning more games? Would his production have been anywhere close? If they had Byard today, would things be a whole lot better? I don't personally think so.
I mean,
but it's easy. I can see a Titans fan going, we used to win when we had Byard and we had Henry and we had Jarrell Casey, you know, all your favorite guys from the past. But things evolve.
Yeah, things evolve. And look, the players that, you know, they do have on this team, they're not, I mean, if you're trying to put together a team to win, this wouldn't be that team that you put together to win ball games. But I think a guy like Xavier Woods, he's playing well. He's graded as one of the best safeties in football. I think he's a top two or three safety in football at this point in time. But the problem with that is that no one else has stepped up their game other than Jeffrey Simmons. No one else on defense has really stepped up. McQuarrie has played solid, but I think McQuarrie has sort of reached his ceiling. He's going to be a good player, a solid player, and he's going to end up – I think he's going to play a long time in this league, because he's just one of those guys, solid player, play a long time, and probably end up coaching after that. But when you have a guy like Xavier Woods that is playing well, but really nobody else outside of Jeffrey Simmons, it doesn't show up, you know, as, oh, that guy is playing well. Because why? He's not making the big plays. He's playing what the defense is calling for him to play. He's coming up. He's making tackles. He's doing the thing that you're asking him to do. But is he getting the interceptions, making the wild plays? No, but he's playing really well. But when you see a team that's completely bad, you don't point out guys like Xavier Woods. You want Kevin Byard. Like if Byard was here, he would be the leader and he would be playing well. Well, Xavier Woods is playing well, and he is one of the leaders. But it's unfortunate that the team is nowhere near winning football games.
We're asking the question, as you divide up why they are where they are, how much of it is on the roster, how much of it is on the coaches? They haven't drafted well. And in my opinion, Byard, guys from the past, from that last text, I don't think it would be much better because those guys have aged. I don't think they're as effective as they were. 3 years in football age is a lot. Here's another text. Why isn't anyone calling out Denard for the defense being, the word of the week, A-double-S? I like him a lot, but as a defensive coordinator, he is A-double-S. His schemes make no sense to me. D-Mace.
Again, I don't have much ammunition to fight, you know, this battle on saying that Denard Wilson is I think he's a good defensive coordinator, because you look at the defense and just like the offense, the defense is trying to hold up their end of the bargain as much as they can, but they just don't have the horses to play the type of defense I think he wants to play. If you know anything about Denard Wilson and where the teams that he's been to, and he said this when he took the job, he said communication is key in this defense because there are a lot of things going on, and you got to communicate. The back end has to communicate with the front. The front, meaning the offensive defensive line, they got to communicate with the back end, those linebackers and everybody. We all got to communicate, because if there's a bust anywhere, we're going to get exposed. One, because we're not that good of a defense. And then two, any halfway decent team, if they blow a coverage, they're going to get exposed eventually. They're not communicating. They're having a hard time, for whatever reason, at communicating. And then once they're playing, it seems like they start to play well. But again, you don't have the horses to play four quarters. So you play well in the first half. Offense is not scoring any points. And then eventually the dam breaks. And what has happened in the second half of just about every game? The teams have opened up and won.
They have really, and we're going to get into that in the 5 o'clock hour, because they really have wilted as the game goes on for sure. A couple of more quick thoughts before we switch gears. We're going to talk to Mitch Light and go around the college football world, in particular down to Tuscaloosa. Ron says, Henry alone could make this offense better. He could really help Cam, and they would bite on the play action. Well, it's been a while since Derrick Henry's been on the team. But this is, again, the theme of if we had the guys from the past, the winners, the winning players, it would be better. But
they tried that, Willie.
They were losing when they had those guys.
Exactly. And I thought they had a better roster his last year than they have now.
Skyler texts what a lot of people say, that compared to winning, quote, winning organizations, the Titans organization, this is his quote, the Titans organization is a joke. That's why these players, especially the vets, don't care. There's no leadership, accountability, no reason to care. I guess that's his take on why you give up a 38-yard play with a couple of veterans involved on a 2nd and 33. That's the theory. I don't know. I can't rule it out.
Yeah, but I can't 100% sit here and say.
I can't 100%.
You know, exactly. Say. They don't care, because if you listen to Jeffrey Simmons, I mean, people raved about Cam Ward, and that's right, Cam, say it. That comes from a place of frustration, even though I don't think he should have used those particular words. But that comes from a place of frustration and people caring. You know, we want to win. So I get what you're saying, Texter, because this team hasn't won and it hasn't looked good. But there are a bunch of guys on this team that care about winning. But caring about winning doesn't win you football games. Talent, execution wins you football games.
Great stuff, and thank you to all the people that had our back with, hey, Kevin Byard is indeed still in the league. You just had 2 interceptions the other day. Thanks, guys. Thanks.
We appreciate you guys.
Appreciate that, guys. Thank you.
All right, when we come back, we're going to talk a little college football with Mitch Light from The Athletic. Vanderbilt, Alabama, featured game, big game. We're going to break it down when we come back. DVD is rolling on this Thursday, and we are about to go to our phone line, which is driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com. It is Mitch Light, college football editor for The Athletic. Big, big weekend of college football. Last weekend was so much fun to watch from start to finish. But Mitch, let's start with the big one that I know everybody here is anticipating from a lot of different angles. But Vanderbilt goes to Alabama. I'll start with this. It was just a thought that popped into my head on Monday, and you've been watching as long as I have Vanderbilt football. Do you think historically there has ever been a game that Vanderbilt has played in that has a bigger spotlight in terms of just the interest in the game, what they're bringing to the table, the storyline from last year, Alabama coming up? I don't think they've ever played in a, quote, bigger game in the spotlight.
No doubt. Not in the modern era. And obviously you're talking pregame. One of my high school friends texted me the other day and I said, biggest game in school history. He said, well, last year it was. I said, the result of the Alabama game ended up maybe being one of the bigger games, but the anticipation, the pregame, and the fact that it's Vanderbilt's being treated as a legitimate opponent, that game day is there with Vanderbilt as the visiting team, all of that adds up to, yes, I'm agreeing with you.
So let's get into a couple of things that I know are going to be general storylines as game day descends. Number one, it will be Vanderbilt snuck up on Alabama last year. Alabama will be ready. They want revenge. Diego Pavia's coming in. So I would take that as a given. So when the line came out at 10.5, and I haven't checked it today to see if it's moved at all, did it surprise you at all, or did you think that was about right based on the perception of this game?
Well, it opened at 12.5, then went quickly down to 10.5 last Sunday or Monday. That's kind of what I expected. You know, betting lines are set for public perception. You know, they're trying to get 50% of the money on each side there. So there's definitely like power ranking by the boys in Vegas as well as perception there. So, you know, I guess if you took the names off the jerseys and just looked at these two teams so far this year, I think most people would say that line's too high, but you can't do that. I mean, that's we've just seen too much. It's not just Vanderbilt and Alabama thing. That's just the way sports works. We have our biases. We know how certain teams have performed historically, so that's all baked into that. So, yeah, I mean, it might be a few points higher than I expected, but I'm not really surprised.
Here's another thing that I'm really curious about. Last year, even with Vanderbilt in the situation they were in, a three-touchdown underdog, they ran the ball extremely well from the outset and all the way to the end of the game against Bama. And I think the consensus is, you've said this, I think anybody who's watched Vanderbilt would say this, that up front, they've improved considerably on the offensive and the defensive lines. How much do you think they can lean on that? Do you think that will play against the most talented team that they've gone up against yet?
Yeah, I think I'd be surprised if Vanderbilt does not have success running the ball. Kalen DeBoer is 2 years there, and it's you know, he's an offensive coach. Kane Womack's a defensive coordinator. They have not really fared well against teams, you know, with running quarterbacks. And you could say that about a lot of teams, but they have fared very well against more traditional defenses. And Vanderbilt is, like you mentioned, better on the offensive line. They've got more weapons, too. You know, last year, Cedric Alexander was banged up a lot, but they've added to the backfield. You know, James L. Lasseter, the redshirt, I mean, the walk-on brings an element of speed that they didn't have last year. Caleb Barnett, a freshman, who's not going to get the ball as a straight carry. He's more of a wide receiver, but they find ways to get him the ball, too. So I just think Vanderbilt has a really good offense. I think Tim Beck is a great offensive coordinator. I think the least of Vanderbilt's worries will be moving the ball on the ground on Saturday.
So where do you think Alabama has the best matchup? Because I think my thought would be, can Vanderbilt stack up defensively against Alabama's offense that really looked good last week?
Yeah, the concern for Vanderbilt would be defensively a couple reasons, a couple things. Vanderbilt has been a slow starting defense this year. You know, pretty much in every game, Virginia Tech went right down the field on them twice. South Carolina did too. You know, Vanderbilt stemmed the tide in that game by that interception at the goal line. Even Georgia State's first possession, they went down and kicked a short field goal. Utah State might have gotten a 3-and-out, but then they scored in the first quarter. Vanderbilt's made great adjustments. We all know the numbers in the second half. So, but Alabama, we saw what they did in the first half last week, and they're a very good passing offense. You know, Ty Simpson has been great the last few weeks. Ryan Williams hasn't really gotten going yet, but Jeremy Bernard, the transfer from Washington, has been really good. So I think that is, if you're looking for Vanderbilt's biggest concern, it would be the pass, you know, slowing down the pass and preventing those big plays from the Alabama passing attack.
We'll talk with Mitch Light of The Athletic discussing college football and the big game this weekend at Alabama and Vanderbilt Vanderbilt traveling to Tuscaloosa to play Alabama. Now, Mitch, the SEC came out with something that's very interesting. I'm sure you saw it. The roster age breakdown. And when I look at – and I would love to know what the roster breakdown of every team is in college football, because I wonder if that determines how good you are. But looking at the SEC, Vanderbilt has the oldest roster when you're talking about graduates or seniors in the SEC. And the team that is second to them, they're not even close. Do you think that contributes to – the winning that Vandy has been doing last year, and more importantly, this year?
Yeah, no doubt. They've gotten old, and they stayed old. And it's really on the lines of scrimmage, too. The offensive line, basically every starter is a fourth, fifth, and I think they've got a sixth-year guy, too. And they had a lot of depth in the portal, even in the spring portal window last year on the defensive line. Some guys who are just kind of role players, but just older guys who have been through the wars. But they're also better this year. Like, they were old on the offensive line last year, and their offensive line was just okay. Their offensive line is above average, I would think, for the SEC this year, even, and it's old. But it no doubt, I mean, you got a six-year quarterback, and I think Diego Pavia is getting, you know, a lot of credit for the people that have really been paying attention for not just being the leader and the wild card and all that. Like, he's playing great football this year, and he knows where to go with the ball. He's just been through it. It's like in any sport, any college sport, the older teams have the advantage. It's still about talent, but if you can have an old team, that's going to help. It's going to help you, and I think that's clearly made an impact for Vanderbilt in the last 2 years.
And that was going to be my next question. Do you think this is sort of an under-the-radar blueprint on teams like Vanderbilt that have been struggling for so long? To, if they can't get that top recruit, or if they can get that one NIL guy or that one portal guy, they go out and get veteran guys that have been in systems, regardless of where they've been, but guys that have played a lot of football.
Yes and no. It's not going to be as easy because we're pretty much seeing the end of the COVID guys, those extra years. So there's got to be some extenuating circumstances, which you see at the line of scrimmage, because you see a lot of guys redshirt. So like you redshirt, and then you play 3 years somewhere, you still have a year of eligibility. So I'm not saying there won't be those old guys you can get. It's sort of like the mid-major model in college basketball. Now, in the past few years, we've seen major conference teams do this in basketball, but for about a five-year span there, it was the teams that those mid-major teams that could get old and stay old that were the ones that were making, you know, runs in the tournament. But so, yeah, I think most coaches would prefer elite talent, but when you don't have access to that talent, to the degree that Vanderbilt doesn't, getting old and staying old is a formula for success.
Let's ask the obvious one that everybody's going to be watching. Diego Pavia, we know, leans into the, hey, I'm here, I'm going to be me, and everybody's looking for bulletin board talk for me, and I'm going to give it to you. That's what he does. But this is going to be, I think, even next level. I'm sure the microscope, he's going to be under the greeting, he's going to get the atmosphere, et cetera. I'm really curious about just the theater part of it.
Well, Derek, you probably don't know this, but when Willie and I were in college, before Vanderbilt played at Rupp Arena, Willie was in the press saying, if we play our game, it's not going to be close.
And what was the final? It wasn't close, but
it wasn't close. Way. I guess you didn't play your game then, Willie. So, yeah, it's like, I think it's gotten beyond the point where, like, Clark Lee is kind of hinted at, you got to let Diego be Diego. And it's like, it doesn't really matter anymore to me. Like, it's just like he says what he says. And if Alabama needs that extra motivation, sure. You know, maybe that's like 5% or 2% more. But they want to beat Diego Pavia badly because he beat him last year and he talked about it. He talked about it this summer and he talked about it this week. So it's just, it's part of the Diego Pavia package, and it works for him. So, you know, in an honest moment, would Clark Lee prefer him not say that? You know, it's not going to be close. Of course, I think he would, but I think that's the least of his concerns this week. Because I think Vanderbilt, if they play their game, they're clearly good enough to beat Alabama. I wouldn't say if they play their game, it's not going to be close. No one really believes that. But it's not. They don't need a heroic effort to beat Alabama.
It's going to be great to watch. Let's bounce around a couple other key games real quick before we let you go, Mitch. behind the scenes, of course, Texas, since that early spotlight game where they really struggled offensively against Ohio State, Arch Manning hasn't been great. They go to Florida, which is not a gimme. This is their toughest test since that Ohio State game. What are you expecting to see?
Yeah, I think one of the, not the biggest matchup in college football this week, but one of the more interesting, because just what's at stake for so much for both teams. Like, if Texas goes there and, you know, Florida's got a really good defense, if Arch kind of lays an egg again offensively, then it's like, okay, this is where we are, I guess. He's going to struggle this year. Not saying he couldn't turn it on late season, but he's had 3 weeks to kind of work the kinks out. So I think it's imperative for Texas, if they want to be a championship-level team, for them to play well offensively. And we all know what's going on with Texas, with Florida and Billy Napier. They need to show some progress offensively. DJ Lagway has been one of the more disappointing quarterbacks in the country. And if they lose and they look miserable on offense like they have, the Boo Birds are going to be out at home, and it's going to put even more pressure. So I just think this game has – as far as pressure on both teams in the SEC, this is the one where you're going to find it the most this week.
Georgia should be fine against Kentucky, but there seems to be a notion after the game against Alabama that Georgia is down a gear from where they've been. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think everyone is. I mean, I think the top of the SEC is down. You just don't have the dominant teams. Georgia was my preseason national championship pick, sort of just didn't want to pick Texas and didn't believe in anyone else that strongly. But you've seen what they've done defensively the last two games to Tennessee and Florida. They've been kind of picked apart in the passing game. So Georgia is a talented team. They're just not elite anymore. They had... You know, when Stetson Bennett was a great college quarterback, but he was able to, you know, lean on an elite defense. Gunnar Stockton's a solid college quarterback. We'll find out more as the year progresses, but his defense isn't quite as good, so maybe the offense needs more from him. So, yeah, I agree with your point that they should be fine this week, but this is not an elite Georgia team.
Each week, you've been not every week, but every time we ask you about Miami, I know you're high on them. Tough test at Florida State. Of course, the Seminoles coming off of a tough loss there. What are you expecting to see there?
Yeah, big test. First time Miami's left home. They're obviously still in the state of Florida, but it's the first road game. I think the key to beating Florida State is just being disciplined defensively and not letting Tommy Castellano kind of do his thing and get comfortable like he did in the Alabama game. If you make them be more of a conventional team and make him throw the ball some, you're going to have success. He threw the ball a ton against Virginia. They lost those games. The earlier games, the Alabama game, I think he had 11 pass attempts. I think Miami is they're elite on the defensive line. If they can, you know, throw out every cliche with a running quarterback, stay in your lanes and all that, I think they will have success slowing him down and putting pressure on the rest of the Florida State offense. I really like Miami to go in there and win.
Mitch, great stuff. We'll talk to you again next week. Enjoy the games this weekend.
All right. Sounds good, guys. Take care.
All right. Mitch Light, straight to the point. A lot of info in a short amount of time. Really good stuff. Looking forward to that Vanderbilt-Alabama game and all the other action. When we come back, we're going to get a little more in-depth into what Derek was asking about with how the breakdown of the rosters are shaping up in the SEC. Just to repeat, Vanderbilt has the highest percentage of graduate seniors, graduate transfers, some of them, I guess, graduated from Vanderbilt, but they are graduate seniors. They are older players. And in contrast, Alabama has one of the lowest percentages, and so does Tennessee. So Tennessee and Alabama tend to be on the younger side, Vanderbilt older. What does that mean, and how will that play out just Saturday and the rest of the season? Is that an equalizer for teams around the country, as D-Mace was asked? What do you think? 615-737-1025. We'll talk about it when we come back here on DVD.